The CBS Radio Network presents a special CBS News broadcast on the Moscow Fair. Our guides return. From New York City, CBS News correspondent George Herman will interview the three American guides who have just returned from the recently concluded American National Exhibit in Moscow. And now to begin the discussion, here is George Herman.
Here in the studio are three of our guides, together with Mr. Charles Vetta, an official of the United States Information Agency who was their supervisor on the trip. Let me introduce to you some of the guides. First, Mrs. Vera Garthoff of Washington, D.C. She's a model and a copyist at the National Gallery. Miss Charlotte Sikowski, acting editor of the current digest of the Soviet press. Mr. Andrew Swatkowski, graduate student at Columbia University. And their supervisor, Mr. Charles Vetter, an official of the United States Information Agency. Ladies and gentlemen, here in the United States, we heard a great deal about what an enormous success you are, how big an impression you made on the Russians. Let me turn the coin over now and ask you, what kind of an impression did the Russians make on you? Vera?
Well, I think numerous impressions, but the one that really stood up is their sincere warmth that they showed toward us and willingness to believe what we told them, not as propaganda, but the real thing, that we were telling the truth and our own experiences.
You really got through?
Quite a number of times, yes. I think majority of times all of us did.
Charlotte, does that agree with your impression?
I share Vera's impression about the warmth, the hospitality of the Russians. I would add, too, that they were very eager to know about the Americans, very curious about our way of life, and even very curious about us personally.
Andrew, you mostly showed off American cars, did you not? Did you get a similar impression of the Russians?
Yes, I felt that the Russians were very interested in the American people, very interested to learn about America. But I also felt that they only had one side, unfortunately, not a full picture of the United States.
They had misconceptions about
the United States. Yes, unfortunately, many misconceptions, but I hope we cleared up just a few of them at least.
Well, we'll get to the misconceptions in a minute. First, I want to ask Mr. Vetter whether this is what the leaders of the American guides, the supervisors, had expected when you took them to the Soviet Union.
Well, I think we were probably prepared for the worst. And in a sense, in our preparation of them, we're trying to prepare them for the worst possible thing. I think, by and large, the curiosity and the warmth and the friendship exceeded any of our anticipations. And was a very fine surprise.
What I'd like to know is, you say, Charles, that you prepared for the worst. How do you prepare young Americans for the worst in Russia? What did you do?
Well, I think we were not trying to prepare anybody in the sense of giving them a set pattern for answering questions. But I think we were trying to prepare them to communicate successfully with the Russian people, to give them some idea of the mental images in the minds of Russians, to give them a little experience in answering questions that the Russians, which we knew the Russians were going to ask and which they did ask, and also to give them a little, you might say, conversational ammunition about their own country, because many of these people were experts on the Soviet Union and the Russian people, but had not had too much experience in studying about the United States.
I wanted to ask you for just a moment about the mechanics of how you prepare Americans for heckling by a Russian crowd.
Well, I might take a situation where I would be a Russian asking you questions, and I might say, "Isn't it true you show us a beautiful model house, and you buy this on the installment plan? But after all, what if you get sick? Don't they take the house away from you? How will you do it?" And we would go ahead on sessions like this in a role-playing, but there's a lot of vicarious participation, and people start thinking of what answers they themselves would give to a situation like this. And
now, you show by your example that you've provided some of the guides with questions. Did you also provide them with answers to these questions?
Well, we had quite an extensive library on the boat going over. And we also had some people who were well-versed in various aspects of these things. And we submitted facts to them and let them take them as they thought proper for answering the questions with their own personality.
Did any of you feel that you had been given answers dictated by American policy, or were you perfectly free?
We were perfectly free.
You said whatever you wanted.
Yes.
I noticed the Soviets time and again asked us, "Did you get any training?" And were you told how to answer? And I personally, I think probably all the other guides, time and again said, no, we were not given any specific training. We were told to answer just the way we felt. But we would ask to be prepared to answer about the United States.
Did you think you got over to them, this
yes.
idea of
yes,
individual action?
Yes, very definitely.
Action?
Because I said, if listen to me, then go and listen to another guide, and you'll see that we differ on slight points. Mm-hmm. None of us has the one answer. I might say that the average wage is so much, somebody else might say it's another. If we'd been given one answer, we would have all voiced the same figure or the same answers.
This was a big element of credibility of the guides, I think, that not only did they not give the same answers, and many times we disagree among ourselves, even in our observations about the fair, but also the Americans generally are candid, and very frequently the guides would admit they were wrong personally or would admit to certain criticisms that had been made. And this is something the Russians, and particularly the agitators, would never do, admit they were ever wrong.
No, I think this was just one of the biggest factors of the exhibit. Guides being willing to admit that our society isn't perfect, that we have a great number of problems, some of them we're even ashamed of, such as racial discrimination, for instance. And this, as Chuck said, would always stop the agitator. And once we said, yes, we do have this problem, but we're trying to face it, we're trying to solve it in our own way, we have made some progress, they'd always be willing to stop and listen to hear another point of view.
Now, you've several times mentioned the presence in the crowd of an agitator.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that you were sabotaged by the Russian government or the Russian Communist Party? Was there any attempt to undercut you?
Well, the agitators were deliberately planted, certainly by the party or by Soviet officials. But what is interesting is that crowds always took care of the agitators for us.
Mm-hmm.
And the one rule was never to get excited, never to get angry, and to exercise infinite patience if you could, because if you were just simply silent, the crowds would finally even turn to an agitator and say, oh, shut up, and let her talk. Or, you know, we don't want to hear about these questions, we want to hear other things.
What, then, were the questions that the agitators mostly had for you? Was there a specific line, or was it various attacks?
Well, Vera? I think it was usually a specific line, the unemployment, the racial, the bases, and you can always usually spot the way it was referred, the way he approached you. Because a lot of times, for instance, unemployment, a lot of Russians were concerned with that, but they really, when they asked me about it, the way they asked is they really wanted to know what it was about. They were given the picture of there were just armies and armies of unemployed, starved people. I think, I'm quite sure of it personally, that they did not believe the picture. But they knew there was a definite problem, and they wanted to know about it. And they asked you, and they want you to clarify it. But an agitator would start dictating, you know, how awful it is that people are starving, start giving statistics, you know, such and such and such.
What do you think was the most unfriendly question or topic that was asked of you, Andrew? Or
well, it's sort of hard to say. It depends how they asked it. For example, they could ask about bases in a friendly way. Why do you surround the Soviet Union with your bases? Or else they could put it in such a way which made you feel that they weren't really interested in an answer. They were just interested in putting you on the spot because they felt you perhaps couldn't answer.
May I ask how a young American student in your case over there would answer a difficult topical, political, and strategic question like why we have bases all around the Soviet Union?
Well, now, I just speak for myself because
precisely.
I know some of the other guides answered it differently. But I told them that I really didn't want to talk about politics because I didn't feel that this was a place, that we'd come over here just to talk about the exhibit and about America and not to really discuss politics, because a discussion of bases necessarily would end up with a discussion of Soviet foreign policy. And this is one thing they didn't seem to like, for us or outsiders to criticize them. Now, I know some of the other guys felt that we should do this, but I frankly felt that I would just like to talk about the United States, about myself, and about the exhibit.
Did any of the rest of you have any topic that you liked to get rid of or sloughed off and declined to answer?
Political questions were always the most difficult, always the most touchy. I also tried Andy's technique to stay clear of political argument, but sometimes they were just so pressing that you simply had to give them some answer, or else they just simply wouldn't be satisfied.
Well, what kind of an answer could you give them to, for instance, the question of the basis?
Well, for instance, I might say that fundamentally we feared the expansionist policy of the Soviet government, that after the war we had disarmed and gone home, But we found that with the expansion of the communist ideology and with certain forms of Soviet domination being imposed upon the satellites and so forth, we just got a little frightened, and that our allies in Europe asked us to come to their defense. And it just so happens that our allies are scattered all around the world. Their allies are very close to home. And very often this got a very favorable response from them.
Mr. Vetter, the only question I can think to ask at this point is, where did you find 80 young Americans who speak Russian so well that they can be sensitive to the feelings of the crowds and to answer these questions on and off?
About 700 people applied for this guide assignment. On paper, they chose about 200 and conducted panels in San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. And in these panels, asking questions to find out the degree of knowledge on one, the United States, on two, the Soviet Union, and on three, on language proficiency, they picked 75 Americans here and five who were already studying either in the Soviet Union or in Europe. Over half of these were of non-Russian or non-Slavic descent.
They were American students of language.
American students of language who had learned either in the universities, at colleges, or perhaps in the armed services.
Now, all of you got over there, you started answering these questions. Were you assigned to specific exhibits? Did you cover something specifically, Charlotte?
Yes, I was at the model house at the almost notorious typical home.
Did the Russians believe that it was a typical American home?
I would say the majority did believe it. But there were many skeptics in the crowds, many skeptics.
Andrew, you were at the exhibit of American cars. What was the chief reaction to American cars?
The reaction was very, very favorable. The only thing that the critics, or the so-called agitators, could say about the cars were they're too low for our roads and there's too much horsepower. Other than that, there was nothing they could say about the cars. And even when they would say they're too low, the Russians around them would say, well, they're built for Americans and not for our roads.
Anybody attempt to buy any?
Quite a few people asked me, would they be on sale? In fact, one man told me that he had 20,000 rubles in his pocket, which would be the equivalent of $2,000, and he wanted to get a cheap car, the $2,000 car, and he wondered if this could be done through the administration.
That was one of the biggest reactions, I think, generally. People wanted to buy the books, particularly. They wanted to buy the things in the exhibits all over the fairgrounds, and they would come up and say, where can we buy it? What happens after the fair is over? I think one of the biggest rumors was the rumor that there was a lottery going to be conducted. This started right when we got there. And that everything there would be, they have state lotteries in the Soviet Union, and that the things would be dispensed of by conducting a big lottery the last day.
As I recall, at the beginning of the fair, there was a considerable fuss. Some American exhibitors returned home rather disgruntled because they were not allowed to give away some of their samples or objects. The Russians ruled against this, I recall. Was this a realistic ruling on the part of the Russians?
Well, I think this was part of the negotiations between the two governments. And generally it was agreed, as I understand it, that all of the things could be sold, but it would have to be sold through an official agency of the Soviet government and distributed from that point.
I was referring to the Russian statement that as a question of handling crowds, they couldn't handle an exhibition in which American samples were given away free. Does that agree with your observations?
I think there was a very great danger in handing out things at the exhibit if you didn't have a large enough supply on hand. Mm-hmm. And I know there were several items that we had planned to give out, which we had in limited numbers, just 100 or several hundred thousand. And it just, the people complained, they said, well, you gave them out yesterday, where are they today? For example, automobile pamphlets and the small buttons similar to this, except much smaller, that were given out to every visitor of the exhibit. To them, this was very important.
This is one of the untold stories, I think, of the fair. These Snetchok had such an emotional significance. First of all, they were being sold in the black market by the kids and by other people in Moscow.
What does the wearing of a button indicate?
It's sort of a status symbol. If they've been there.
They've seen it.
And you would think that they would not wear something identifying them with the United States, but you'd see them in the subways, the waiters in the restaurants, and people traveling after many of the guides traveled to
to Tbilisi and to Georgia, and they found people wearing these all over the Soviet Union where they went to.
Well, this brings me to, I think, another important question, and that is, how thoroughly did we breach the Iron Curtain in this American exhibition? How well did we reach down into the Russian people, into the roots of Russia? Anybody have an answer?
Well, I think it was just a most auspicious beginning. This was really the first time that the people had had actual human contact with Americans. They were seeing Americans for the first time. They were talking with them. They were, and this is important too, I think, free to ask questions on the exhibit site. They didn't hold back on anything that I can think of in terms of what they wanted to know about our way of life. And this personal contact with the Americans meant a great deal to them.
I'd go right along with that. I think this was the first time they heard people say that they didn't like perhaps certain things in the Soviet Union. And I think that people get sort of tired reading the paper and reading Pravda and Izvestia and always reading about how wonderful everything is in the Soviet Union and how nothing ever goes wrong. And suddenly, for the first time, they're speaking to people who disagree with them a bit.
Are they? Did you get any indication that the Russian people, mass of the Russian people, are able to hear the Voice of America broadcasts?
People brought this up very frequently. I am sorry to say that the majority always said that they did not like the Russian language broadcasts. They felt that the people responsible for these broadcasts didn't really know what was going on in the Soviet Union, and very often made statements that were, to the Soviets anyway, foolish. And they would also always say, for instance, that BBC did a better job in that respect. So it was a little hard defending our position on that ground. At least it was for me, because I don't know too much about the Voice. But they are interested. They do try to listen. And
well, they hear the music programs. And you can go all over the Soviet Union and find Soviet orchestras playing American arrangements, which they get off of the Music USA. They have a lot of tape recorders in the Soviet Union. I think you found... I was surprised how many tape recorders.
Well, I have never heard so much jazz in my life as I heard the past 6 weeks.
Where did you go?
What was interesting, another thing that they commented on was the religious programs that they heard. I had a lot of people tell me that they were listening to the religious programs that came over the air.
Were you asked questions, skeptical or cynical questions about religion to any extent?
Well, yes, very definitely. I was constantly asked, do you believe in God or in a religion? And if so, which one? And many a time they would laugh if I said that I did. Because I think most of them are taught in school that religion is, well, it's just, it's incompatible with present-day education.
It's funny, though. Excuse me, on this religion, I think some of us picked up a counter current that I had one student from Moscow University tell me that after the 20th Party Congress and the denigration of Stalin, many of the idols were broken for the idealist. And now many of the students have become skeptical about the idealism of communism. And quite a few people are now turning back to religion, not so much to the Russian Orthodox Church, but to other sects, such as the Baptists and some of the other Christian sects, to find answers to fill that ideological or that ideal need that they're looking for.
Do the Russian people, as far as you could see in your contact with them, do they equate this return to other values with Nikita Khrushchev in person?
I didn't think so. At least my personal opinion is not.
He's sort of a pragmatist, and I think they admire him as a doer.
Yeah.
They admire him, I think, to the extent that things have improved considerably since the death of Stalin. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think they equate the improvement in living conditions and generally in the political situation with the death of Stalin and the rise to power of Malenkov and then Khrushchev.
One of the films we saw at the beginning of the program showed Mr. Khrushchev making his way through the middle of an enormous crowd of the proportions that the Secret Service would hardly let President Eisenhower go through. Is he popular? Is he in no danger from the people wherever he goes?
Well, he doesn't walk Gorky Street, I don't think, by himself.
But I saw him there in the crowd of Russians. Do they like him? Do they have a feeling of affection or respect? Could you tell in the answers to the questions?
I think it sort of depends upon what group of people you're dealing with, I think workers, for instance, and collective farmers, have a genuine like for Khrushchev. I think that some of the intelligentsia admire him for the changes that he's brought about since Stalin's time, but think that he's a little coarse, that he is not quite representative of a cultured individual and so forth.
I don't think there's any doubt, though, that basically he is accepted as their national and their international leader. And I think we have to recognize that he does have that basic acceptance among the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Khrushchev is very shortly coming over here, as we all know, on a visit to the United States. What will be the reception among the Russian people, the people that you talked to in the fair, the people who questioned you, if there should be some unfortunate incident, if Mr. Khrushchev should be hit with an egg or an overripe tomato? What is it going to do to the Russian people that you saw? Is it going to infuriate them, or will they understand?
I think they're going to be shocked, because they look upon this whole thing as sort of heavenly manna. At least the people I talk to, they always say, well, treat him well, you know, after all, he's ours. And they sort of associate to that respect. You know, the people and the Khrushchev become one. And another thing is that they think now, because of this visit, everything is going to be solved. Their economic conditions are going to be so much better because the Cold War will be reduced and they'll start producing consumer goods. I don't know, I have never seen such a completely naive approach of people in general. I think they're so sophisticated people.
Andrew?
I think that's very true. The one word that I heard over and over again was mir and druzh, peace and friendship. And I think they really feel that this meeting might lead to a peace. And if something like this would happen, I'm sure they would feel that this is just an attempt on certain people in this country to thwart peace. Well, they sincerely hope that peace is going to come of it.
That's the point I wanted to get to. Do the Russian people in general understand the freedom in this country of splinter groups, of emigres from the fringes of the Soviet Union, from the Iron Curtain, their freedom to act on their own, to say unpleasant things, and the fact that we can't control them? Do they understand this danger and this problem, do you think?
This is a question I very frequently raised with crowds when they would say, how will Khrushchev be received? I would tell them that I think he will be received courteously, but perhaps not always very warmly. Because we do have certain anti-Soviet organizations, they are free to organize, and so forth. And very often they would ask, why do you allow such organizations then? And this, of course, leads to another discussion, a political discussion.
Charles, from your point of view as an official of the United States Information Agency, how do you think the Russian people would react if there should be some minor incident, however minor, but unpleasant incident with Mr. Khrushchev?
I think that it would hurt what we've tried to do in opening communication channels. These people are very sensitive right now. I like to draw the comparison between some of our attitudes back in the 1920s and 1930s, when we were just emerging and trying to get acceptance in the world community. And I think this might be quite a setback to this process of trying to get through and get some kind of opening of the channels and relaxing of the tensions where we can get facts to the people, not just to the government.
I'm sorry to say that our time has expired. I want to thank you all for giving us an idea of what you saw as you looked through the Iron Curtain, to thank you for being with us here today.
You have been listening to a special CBS News broadcast, The Moscow Fair, Our Guides Return, a discussion of the Russian reaction to the American National Exhibit in Moscow, as experienced by three American guides who have just returned to the United States. CBS News correspondent George Herman was the moderator. The Moscow Fair, Our Guides Return, was produced by George Vikas, Bob Rubin, associate producer. This has been a public affairs presentation of CBS News.
This is the CBS Radio Network.